13-20-261-CV, certain underwriters at Lloyd's of London, subscribing to policy number NAJL05000016-887 as a subrogee of Momentum Hospitality Inc. versus, I'm not sure if it's Macy or Mace and Associates Inc. And it was consolidated with the following cause number 13-20-377-CV. Certain underwriters at Lloyd's of London et al., as previously stated, versus the Amato Conversano Inc. DBA DCI Engineer.
Good afternoon. Jeffrey Learned for plaintiff appellants, certain underwriters at Lloyd's. These two consolidated appeals involve the same central issue. What does section 150.002 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code require of certificates of merit? And were the certificates of merit from underwriters experts in these two cases sufficient? As to DCI, there is also an issue as to whether or not it waived the right to seek a dismissal under 150.002. As to that issue, I'm happy to answer any questions the court may have, but otherwise I will rely on my briefs. Turning to the statutory issue, what does section 150.002 require? In general terms, it imposes five requirements on third-party professionals providing a certificate of merit. They must be competent to testify. They must be licensed or registered in the state of Texas. They must have the same professional license or registration as the defendant. They must be actively engaged in the practice of architecture, engineering, or surveying, and they must practice in the area of practice of the defendant. Now, it's the final requirement that's at issue in these two appeals. This requirement defines both the type of practice to which the professional must be familiar, along with the requisite level of the professional's familiarity in order to have a valid certificate of merit. Prior to September of 2009, the statute had pretty high standards for both aspects. With regard to the type of practice, it had to be the same area of practice as the defendant. And the requisite level of familiarity was practicing in that area. Then in 2009, the legislature amended the statute and both requirements were reduced. It no longer required that the expert practice in the same area. They only need to practice in the area of practice of the defendant. And as to the requisite level of familiarity, it only required now knowledge in that area. And that's the way it was for 10 years. And then in 2019, the legislature amended the statute again. It kept that level of practice at the same level, not the same area of practice, but just the area of practice. But the legislature reinstated the level of familiarity back to the level of practicing in that area. So in essence, since September of 2009, the legislature has only required an expert providing a certificate of merit to have familiarity with the defendant's area of practice. Clearly, the legislature does not require familiarity with the same area of practice of the defendant. If it did, it would have added back that magic word same that it took out in 2009. Now, many appellate courts in Texas have reached this very same conclusion, including this court. In BHP Engineering and Construction versus Heil Construction Management, this court, including two members of today's panel, held, quote, Chapter 150 does not state the affiant's knowledge must relate to the same, much less the same specialty area of practice. So Section 150.002 doesn't require knowledge, or in this case now, practicing in the same area of practice. But by the same token, it's not simply enough that the expert be registered or licensed have the same registration or license as the defendant. There's something in between that's required. And we submit that the only reasonable conclusion, if you don't have to be in practicing in the same area of practice, the expert needs to practice in the general area of practice as the defendant. So the question then becomes, regarding Mr. Kaufman, regarding DCI, and regarding Mr. Idle, regarding Mays? Do they practice in the respective defendant's general area of practice? Now, turning to DCI first and Mr. Kaufman. Ironically, the fact that DCI probably disagrees with what I've just said about what 150.002 says doesn't matter, because DCI and us agree what's going to be required to satisfy the statute here. And that is Mr. Kaufman must be practicing structural engineering. DCI stated that in its brief, its original brief on page 22, where it said the third party professional making the affidavit must practice in the same areas of practice as defendant. In this case, that is structural engineering. DCI went the extra mile and filed a certify brief, and they said it again. A third party engineer such as Kaufman must be practicing in the area of the defendant, which is structural engineering, DCI engineer's area of practice. So does Mr. Kaufman practice structural engineering?
Can we stop and talk about one more case before we start specifically talking about the facts? And I'd really like to talk about the Bistolone case, which was also out of our court. And I don't think I was on the original panel on that case coming out of this court, but Justice Longoria was, which was also on the Heil case, which we were on panel. So in Bistolone, one of the issues that they seem to have in that case in reversing our opinion was what evidence was before the court to substantiate the practice of area of the engineers or the experts under 150.02. So when you're talking about the affidavits of these two individuals, I think it's important to zero in as to what was before the trial court to decide whether they, because she seemed to struggle, and both of you point that in your brief, and she actually invites us to look at this area specifically, Judge Watley does in this case, as to what exactly is meant and what was put before her, because she gets very zeroed in on that forensic architect, forensic engineer in that testimony. So can you kind of, I know I asked the big question, but I didn't want you to fray too far away without really addressing the issues for us this afternoon.
Certainly. Well, let's start with the Levinson case, which is the one you're referring to, the Supreme Court decision. When you look at that case, it does not hold, as May suggests, it doesn't say that we're reading back in a same area of practice requirement. If you look at the facts of Levinson, the architect in that case provided a simple certificate of merit that said, I'm an architect licensed in Texas, and I have an active architecture practice. Unlike Mr. Kaufman and Mr. Idle, he provided no details as to what was that practice or how in any way it might correspond with what the defendant's practice was. Now, the plaintiff in that case argued, well, it's enough that he actively practices architecture. This court held it's enough that he holds the same professional license. Now, the Levinson court held, all the Levinson court held, was that more was required than either the plaintiff or this court suggested. And importantly, it stated, we conclude then that the statute's knowledge requirement is not synonymous with the expert's licensure or active engagement in the practice. It requires some additional explication or evidence reflecting the expert's familiarity or experience with the practice area. Note, the court did not say same practice area, because nothing exists in Payne's affidavit from which to draw an inference that Payne possessed knowledge of the defendant's area of practice. Beyond the generalized knowledge associated with holding the same license, we conclude Payne has not shown himself qualified to render the certificate of merit. We don't disagree with that. There are, as I said at the very start, being licensed and having an active practice are two independent requirements under the statute. You must also show practice in the area of practice of the defendant. Mr. Kaufman and Mr. Idle both provide that in paragraph ones in their respective affidavits, which were before the lower court. Now, the lower court absolutely did get all messed up on the whole forensic versus design distinction, which frankly, from reading the briefs, doesn't really seem to be the basis upon which either defendant is really defending the decision now. Partially because there's ample case law saying that forensic engineering and design engineering are very similar, and I will get to that. But I don't think Levinson changes anything. It certainly doesn't have any impact on whether or not you need to have the same area of practice. It did not read into the statute what was taken out in 2009. And I understand that the Mays cited the Jacobs Field Services decision, a post-Levinson decision, but certainly appears that they did decide to read back in. With all due respect to that court, I think they went beyond and acted almost like a judicial legislature, but with all due respect to them, they basically added the word same or similar back into that statute. But just to be clear, Jacobs Field Services isn't the only post-Levinson appellate court decision. We cited one that was issued actually 1 month before Jacob Field Services, and that was the H.W. Lochner case out of the 12th District. And that case holds exactly what we're advocating here. And I quote, although at one time an expert authoring a report under Chapter 150 had to practice in the same area of practice as the defendant, the statute was amended in 2009 to delete that requirement. The plain language of Section 150.002 does not require the opining professional to demonstrate expertise in the defendant's subspecialty. Section 150.002 does not require the affiant to state that he is knowledgeable in the same area of practice of the defendant. Rather, it requires him to be knowledgeable in that area. And we believe that that is clearly the standard that should be applied. Now let's turn to what was before the district court, the affidavits of the two experts. With regard to Mr. Kaufman, he stated that he is registered engineer in Texas. He has 8 years experience in civil, structural, and professional engineering. In the past, he performed structural engineering designs similar to DCI, and he is currently actively engaged in the practice of forensic engineering, which, quote, includes various components of structural engineering, close quote. Now, if you look at the civil practice and remedy, or sorry, that the occupations code, section 1001.003, which defines practice of engineering, it states that that includes consultation, investigation, evaluation, analysis, providing an engineering or opinion or testimony, et cetera. Well, that's clearly what a forensic engineer does. A forensic engineer applies engineering principles to investigate why a building failed, why there was a loss. A designer uses those same principles to build it. The forensic engineer uses those same principles to determine why it failed. Clearly.
Go ahead, please. Were you going to ask a question, Nora?
No, go ahead.
So are you saying that the statute does not require them to be, for example, an architect that designs commercial buildings, i.e. hotels, in order to meet the requirements under Chapter 150?
Yes, we do not think that that's what's required. That would be if the requirement was same area of practice, then probably would be, but that's not in the statute anymore. We think under the way the statute's worded, it's the general area. So we have Mr. Kaufman, who's clearly practicing engineering, but that's not enough to get us over the finish line as to DCI. Mr. Kaufman must be currently practicing structural engineering. Again, we agree with DCI on that. And again, if you go back to his affidavit, paragraph one, he states his current practice of forensic engineering includes various components of structural engineering. So he is applying structural engineering principles in his forensic engineering practice. We believe that that qualifies as the practice of structural engineering, and that means that he satisfied 150.002. Now, as to Mays, and I see my time is running out, and that's fine. I want to stress one thing that the district court overlooked, and frankly, Mays's attorneys don't really talk about too much on appeal. Even if you take a very, very restrictive view of 150.002, and say that it requires the same area, which it doesn't, Mr. Idle, in some respects, does practice in the same area as Mays. He states that Since 2000, he has also provided peer review and technical support services to other architects and professionals during design for new construction. So in other words, when another architect or structural engineer provides plans for new construction, one of the things that Mr. Idle does is he looks them over to make sure they comply with building codes, proper principles of building construction and what have you. That's exactly what Mays does. And that's one of the failures we said Mays did here. Mays concedes that as an architect of record, it was responsible for supervising and monitoring the construction process. This included reviewing all DCI designs to make sure building codes were followed. In essence, what Mays did here, they subcontracted out the structural design work to DCI. They had that right to do so. But they were also obligated to review those designs and make sure that they were proper. We say they were not. Well, that's exactly what Mr. Idle does as well. So at least as to that negligence, they actually satisfy even the higher same level of practice requirement. And I see my time is up, so I will stop.
May it please the court, I am Stan Deneg. I represent Mays and Associates, the architect of record for this multi-million dollar 85 room, four-story new construction in Rockport. As is referenced in our brief, Mays's scope of work was detailed in the AIA contract that the plaintiffs attached to their petition. This contract sets out substantial and detailed tasks. The underwriters allege that Mays and the other defendants are partly responsible for damage that the hotel sustained through Hurricane Harvey in 2017. Underwriters had more than 2 years to find a qualified architect to support their claims against my client. And in the end, they came up with an architect who describes his own practice as involving diagnosing water infiltration and a vague description about peer review and technical supports of architects and professionals. That's it. You will note that this affidavit does not state any details about this peer review and technical support. It does not say that he practices in Mays' area of practice, does not say that he has knowledge of Mays' area of practice. He does not say that his practice includes anything in the Rockport area. Does not say he is currently performing professional services on a project like the one at issue. Doesn't say that he ever performed professional services on a project like the one at issue. Does not say that he's ever signed, been a party to an AIA contract like what is attached to the underwriter's petition, and doesn't describe any work history to lead one to believe that
Mr. Denning, are you saying that all of those things you've enumerated would be required for a certificate of merit?
I am saying that a proper certificate of merit should contain some of the things on that list. And if you look at all of the cases that the parties have,
some of them, but not all of them, because
No, of course not. No. I'm just giving factual examples of things that could be on a certificate of merit that would lead the court to believe that Mr. Idle was qualified to sign it.
That begs the question of, you've listed a remuneration. How much of that, if any, is critical in order to meet statute 150? If he says, well, I do hotels in Rockport, But is it really important as to the geographical location, how big the hotels are? That bears the question of what is important under Chapter 150?
Well, what's important, and I'm going to get to that, Your Honor, is in the Levinson case, the court asked about the affiant's knowledge of background on the design of, in that case, it was a shopping center or similar shopping centers. Our position ultimately is the court and Judge Whatley properly looked at the underlying project in determining whether or not Mr. Idle was qualified to sign that certificate of merit. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, so that goes back to kind of one of the questions that I asked or tried to address with, which I thought was important in the Pistolone case, was what was the evidence before the trial court in order to make the determination as to whether either one of these individuals met the chapter of 150. Pistolone to me seemed to indicate more that there was lacking some evidentiary issues in that case. And I wanted to see if we believe the affidavits or the reports in this case were also, you appear to be lacking in that information.
Pistolone, as I understand it, just basically said that he was a licensed architect and he practiced for a certain number of years. And the court said that that's not enough. And then
so we have more in this case. The question is, do we have enough? It becomes that whole subjective test that we have to go back and forth as to whether it's the expert reports or certificate of merits or under Daubert and Robinson's as to whether the gatekeepers. So then that begs me the question is, what are we supposed to be reviewing this case under? Is it an abuse of discretion? I forgot to look. Do we remember, Mr. Dinner, what are we reviewing this case on, a standard of review?
You review the evaluation of the statute de novo, and once you reach a conclusion, it is discretionary. And we would argue that that under the statute, there has to be some showing that the affiant practiced in the same area of practice as Mr. Mays. And here, the amendment of the act was supposed to be to make the act stricter.
Mr. Denning, so is that the crux of your argument? I know that Mr. Learned wants to say that we're not talking about the same area now, but you're saying we still need to look at the same area of practice, because I think we need to find that standard, because we don't want to have appellate review for every single certificate of merit, right? So we want you guys to know what that standard is. He's saying general area, but you're still saying same.
I'm not saying same. Mr. Learned has focused on this word same and argued that the use of the same somehow poisoned everything about this case. My argument is, let's go back to what the court asked in the Levinson case and look for some evidence that the affiant had a background in the practice arising out of the project that the lawsuit is focused on. And I think that's a fair inquiry. And you don't have to use the word same. What you have to ask is, this guy qualified to give opinions about another architect on this project? So, and our argument is, well, let's look at what Mr. Idle says his practice is. His practice is, well, I did something with some water intrusion, and I also did some peer review. Is there any way that rises to the level of practice that's required to design a five-story hotel? That is, I think, our bottom line here.
I think, Counselor, are you saying that, like, the statute, I guess, the new one, the 2019 statute under the standards, where am I losing my place? That the same practice in the area of practice is the same as saying the same area of practice.
It means the same to me. It means it's, a lot of courts have said it means the same thing. And interestingly, in the underwriter's brief that it submitted to Judge Whatley, it characterized the statute with the word same in it at least twice. So now they're saying that the whole thing's poisoned because of the word same, which, by the way, was not, I don't believe she commented on in her comments, and certainly wasn't in the ruling. So I'm not, the word same is something that's been thrown out just as a red herring, I think, in this particular situation.
Assuming with me that their expert on this case, Mr. Idle, is a forensic architect, for whatever that is a forensic architect practice in the same area as the Macy architects?
Okay, I'm gonna try to answer the question. I think the characterization of forensic or not is not the focus, because you could be a forensic expert and could practice in Mr. Mays's area. The courts look to not what you call the guy, whether he's forensic or not, but they look for his qualifications in the cases that have been cited, that these quote forensic experts have all sorts of proper experience, and the courts have allowed them to serve as affiants. And personally, I think that the judge meant in her comment about forensic. Oh, is my time up?
That's okay. You can finish your sentence.
That in her opinion, Mr. Idle was just not qualified. And she said at the time, look, I haven't read the briefs yet. I'm going to go read the briefs and do some research, and I'm going to rule. And she did so in 6 days.
All right. Let's hear from the other appellee in this consolidated case.
May it please this honorable court. DCI's position is that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in granting DCI's motion to dismiss with prejudice because of the clear qualification requirements to author a certificate of merit affidavit were not present in the affidavit of Bradley Kaufman, and in fact were affirmatively disproven by his very affidavit and were not established by any other competent information. We have talked about the 2019 changes, and I agree that the focus should be on subpart 3 of 150.002, which states that a claimant shall be required to file with the complaint an affidavit by a licensed professional engineer who practices in the area of practice of the defendant. The wording of subpart 3, I believe, is plain, concise, and easy to understand and should be given its ordinary meaning. It requires that the expert practices in the area of practice of the defendant, as contrasted with the immediately preceding version of the statute, which only required that he be knowledgeable in the area of practice of the defendant. Clearly, the change was intended to heighten the bar that an expert has to go over in order to file a certificate of merit affidavit that's viable. The expert must currently practice in the area of practice of the defendant. Mr. Kaufman does not currently practice in the area of practice of DCI or of its employee, Chris Swanson, who was the engineer of record for the structural drawings. The legislative history makes this interpretation fairly clear. The author of this amendment stated that Senate Bill 1928 would require the affiant to actually practice in the same area as the defendant, and would mean that the affiant has experience in the area rather than just claiming knowledge of it. Well, the affidavit of Bradley Kaufman affirmatively shows that he did not practice in the area of practice as DCI and did not engage in structural engineering.
Well, doesn't he say in the affidavit, as I'm reading the affidavit of Mr. Kaufman, I have in the past performed structural engineering designs for commercial structures similar to the subject property as well as residential structures. And if we go back to Mr. Denier's litany of what he says, he talks about the same structural, the same type of buildings. So doesn't that suffice the requirement as you're setting forth?
Note No, it doesn't, Your Honor, because the current statute specifically says he must practice, currently practice, in the area of the defendant. It does not say practice in the past or have practiced. It says the expert practices in the area of practice of the defendant. And Mr. Kaufman specifically averts he does not do so currently. I would point you to his affidavit, in which right after making that statement that he actively practices forensic engineering, he says, I have in the past performed structural engineering designs. And in the final sentence says, accordingly, I have in the past engaged in the same areas of practice as engineers employed by DCI. So this paragraph shows that while he was a civil engineer and engaged in forensic engineering, he admits that in the past, but not presently, he practiced structural engineering. And in the past,
as a forensic current practicing in forensic engineering, that does not meet the requirements of practice in the area. He has to be practicing engineering, not structural engineering.
Yeah, but you know, it would depend on the case. I think this is a case where the wrong expert was perhaps selected, but it depends on what the case is about. But a forensic engineer can be very helpful and useful to the court and the jury on causation issues, for example, and which is primarily how they're used. He's being asked to stretch and talk about structural matters, which he 8 years ago or so in the past did do, but has not currently done. And he doesn't say how long he has not currently done it. So I want to, if I may, address one other point of his affidavit before we move on.
Of course.
He does say that he let me go back to it real quick.
Fine.
His practice of forensic engineering includes various components of structural engineering, but nowhere in this affidavit does he define what components of structural engineering he uses in his practice, or how or if they relate to his work in this case. His affidavit is simply deficient in that. And he doesn't state why he stopped practicing structural engineering. When you compare his affidavit, and particularly the last sentence, I think it's clear that he understood and was pointing out that when the phrase practices in the area of practice was used, it meant that he needs to currently practice in that area. And as is now beyond dispute, that area of practice would have been structural engineering, which is the defendant's area of practice. The additional proof of that, Your Honor, besides the wording of the legislative history and even Mr. Kaufman's own affidavit, where he states that I have in the past engaged in the same area of practice as engineers employed by DCI, is the website of the Texas Board of Professional Engineers, which allows engineers to list their branches or areas of practice. Chris Swanson of DCI lists it as structural engineering. Mr. Kaufman lists his as civil engineering, and Mr. Swanson prepared a very detailed declaration in support of DCI's motion to dismiss, which clearly explains the differences between a structural engineer and a civil engineer, including the educational differences, the testing requirement differences, and the differences in those practices. And Mr. Kaufman's own affidavit recognizes that forensic engineering and structural engineering are different areas of practice. So in this case, we believe that the central question presented is whether our trial judge abused her discretion when she dismissed the case after reviewing the motion to dismiss, its attachments, the certificate of merit, and the briefing of counsel on both sides. Stated another way, given the evidence she was presented, was her decision clearly erroneous such that no reasonable judge would have held as she held in this case? And here's what she had. The language of subpart three that says that the new requirement is that the expert practices in the area of the defendant. And then she has Kaufman's admission in his affidavit. He is not currently practicing structural engineering and that he does not practice in the same area as DCI currently, although he has in the past. He recognizes that DCI and he have different areas of practice. And just because he has practiced some point in the past as a structural engineer doesn't mean he is currently competent to do so. And by not listing structural engineering as one of his branches in which he believes he's competent, he may not consider himself competent to testify as a structural engineer. Finally, I think it is important that the city of Rockport requires only that structural engineers sign and seal plans that are submitted involving windstorm analysis. And under that definition, Mr. Kaufman could not have practiced in the same area because he could not have submitted such structural plans as were submitted by DCI to the city of Rockport. So we submit that these factors clearly support the trial court's decision and indicate she did not abuse her discretion and would respectfully request the ruling of the court be affirmed. All right.
Any questions for either appellee from Justice Longoria Tejerina? All right. So Lorne, you've got your final 5 minutes. I kind of would like you to start where Mr. Lulites just ended. Do they, he adds a time issue to 150. Is that correct? Do they have to be currently practicing in that area? And if so, is Mr. Kaufman currently practicing in that area?
Yes, they do have to. Mr. Kaufman has to be currently practicing in the area of structural engineering. We submit that when he says, I am currently, as in I am actively engaged in the practice of forensic engineering, which includes various components of structural engineering, we submit that is practicing structural engineering. He is taking structural engineering principles as a forensic engineer. And you don't have to take my word for it. We attached, and it's been discussed in the briefs, Mr. Kaufman reached out to the Texas Board of Professional Engineers and Land Surveyors. And in the record, it's on our appendix, page 32, 401 of the DCI record, is the email from the senior investigator of that agency, the people who license engineers in Texas. And he said, in my opinion, forensic engineers that investigate various types of projects to determine if the designs were adequate and or deficient, do that level of work based on their competence in the engineering work being investigated. And as such, again, in my opinion, that level of work would appear to suffice for practicing in the area of specialty of the defendant. So they even go further. They say it's the same specialty. But we certainly submit that someone who is actively engaged in forensic engineering, which includes components of structural engineering, is indeed practicing in that area. Now, to follow up even further, there's discussion about, well, his area of competency is civil engineering, so he can't act as a structural engineer. Look at the statutes, and these are all set forth in our briefs. Texas Administrative Code 137.97H states, a license issued by the board is as a professional engineer, regardless of branch designations or specialty practice. Practice is restricted only by the license holder's professional judgment and the applicable board rules regarding professional practice and ethics. It then goes on in subsequent paragraphs to talk about you can put forth what your primary area of competency is, There's no question that Mr. Kaufman has submitted his primary area of competency as civil engineering. But the statute doesn't say you're restricted to only working in areas that's your primary area of competency. In fact, if you look at the Texas Administrative Code 13759A, all it says is engineers shall practice only in their areas of competence. And the next section says an engineer shall not perform any engineering assignment for which the engineer is not qualified by education or experience. So what is Mr. Kaufman's background? His education he has, including a master's degree in civil engineering with a structural focus from Texas Tech University. His experience, as he said in his affidavit, 8 years of experience in engineering, including structural, plus in the past, performing structural engineering designs for commercial structures like the hotel. So the statute says if you're qualified by education or experience to practice structural engineering, you can do that. Well, he has both. So he is quite qualified to do structural engineering. He's done it in the past. He's still doing it. He's just doing it as a forensic engineer now. And just to conclude and to sort of go back.
I wanted to talk to you regarding the litany of, as it pertained to Mr. Idle, as to whether that he's designed hotels in the same area and the litany that we got from Mr. Dined. Do we have to have those, any of them, all of them, one of them?
I don't believe you have to. I mean, when he was going through his litany, I was like, well, if it was the same area of practice, he'd probably be right. Or if it was the same subspecialty, he'd probably be right. But that's not what the statute says. And he did tell us that, and it's not so limited. They're making it sound like, oh, he's just did, you know, Mr. Idle only looked at a couple of water losses. For 20 years now, actually 21 years this year, he has been investigating, his best practice has included, it's not been limited to, it's included investigation of existing buildings to diagnose problems such as water infiltration and to develop repairs. And then of course, the critical point, as well as peer review and technical support services to other architects and professionals during design for new construction. Now, Mays wants us to drill down further. I'm not so certain, I mean, pretty soon you'd have to have an affidavit of merit that's 15 pages long. I'm certain they'd still find something wrong with it. Remember, at the end of the day, what's the purpose of this statute? It's not to get rid of as many cases as we can against professional engineers. This statute simply says we want to make sure we weed out frivolous cases. Now, if they want to make a Daubert challenge against an expert subsequently down the line, it may not be a frivolous, we don't have a frivolous case, but if they think that he doesn't have a, they can do that later. But there is authority that this is not a Daubert decision at this point in time. This is simply, have we asserted a meritorious case? And we submit that if you look at the body of the affidavits of both experts we've submitted, this is not a frivolous case. It should not have been dismissed. And this matter should be remanded. Thank you.
All right. Anything further from Justice Longoria Tejerina?
No.
All right. We will, this case will be under submission.